Joe Biden, UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, Chinese Premier Chiang, and heads of invited countries like Bangladesh and Mauritius have all arrived in New Delhi. They witnessed cultural programs on tarmac at the airport and three bilaterals with Prime Minister Narendra Modi at Lok Kalyan Marg, which is the official residence of Prime Minister of India, are over already. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the special broadcast on G20. Delhi Declaration is almost ready, is what G20 Sherpa Amitabh Kant has said. What are the points of agreements? And what about the disagreements? First, let's listen in to what Mr. Kant had to say.
The New Delhi Leaders' Declaration, which many of you will see post the summit, you will see it as a voice of the Global South and the developing countries. No document in the world would have such a strong voice for the Global South and the developing countries as the New Delhi Leaders' Declaration. New Delhi Leaders' Declaration is almost ready. I would not like to dwell on it because this declaration will be recommended to the leaders and the leaders will then accept it. And only after it has been accepted by the leaders.
And today was also the day when Prime Minister, while welcoming the dignitaries, spelt out the mantra for this summit. He put out a detailed thread on X saying India's G20 presidency has been inclusive, ambitious, decisive and action-oriented. Prime Minister Modi had three bilaterals, about which I just spoke. In all, there are 15, which will happen in the next 48 hours. Engagement with Prime Minister Jagnauth of Mauritius, in fact, focused on cooperation in sectors like infrastructure, fintech, and reiteration of India's commitment to furthering the voice of the Global South. With Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina of Bangladesh, it was on connectivity and commercial linkages. And then the big handshake over dinner with US President Joe Biden. The agenda was trade issues, jet engine, and also on technology cooperation under the initiative on critical and emerging technology. Tomorrow is the day of negotiations and discussions. Lots of visuals have already come in. There'll be lots of visuals also coming in tomorrow. Joining me on the show, Michael Kugelman, a South Asia Institute Director of the Wilson Center. We have Ambassador Manjeev Puri. He is India's former representative to the UN and Nepal. Dr. Bharat Barai is member of Overseas Friends of BJP. We have Andrew K.P. Leung, China strategist. I'm going to begin with you, Ambassador Puri. The New Delhi Declaration is almost ready, is the message that is coming from the Sherpa of G20, and it will be taken up for discussion tomorrow. What is it that the world wants out of this G20 New Delhi?
Thank you very much for the question. And I think we have to go by the words of the Sherpa. And he said that this will be a very strong document reflecting the voice of the Global South. And I want to believe that actually the world also wants to do something which is for the Global South, because time today is such. It's a time requiring cooperation, collaboration, and doing things together. Let me give you one simple example. The issue of climate change, which, you know, we all talk about in various ways. But let's look at our friends in Africa, who recently had, just a few days back, had a huge, big African climate convention. The world is generally ready to do something. Ways and means have to be found in which we manage to do that. And the G20 is a perfect forum for that. So my understanding is that the world wants to see that we bring about cooperation that is important for the entire world, important for the Global South. Let me highlight just a few things. The issue of digital public infrastructure, where India has been a human leader of the world in terms of what we have done. The issue of women to lead developmental efforts. The issue of cryptocurrencies. And in fact, the biggest of them all in that sense. Money for sustainable development, seeing that the SDGs are brought back on target, and money for green climate development. These are some of the big issues. And I think that the world generally is on one page. I have the Sherpa's word for it, and I am happy to take it for that.
Okay, let me ask Michael Kugelman, is the world really on one page? Let's not forget that there is absence, the visible absence of Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin as well.
Well, I mean, I think the world is on the same page in a very broad, lowest common denominator context, in that I would argue that all the G20 members would agree in principle on the need to address global challenges like climate change and food insecurity and so on. But, you know, I think that in terms of the agenda items that all the members would like to focus on at the summit, then no, I mean, they're certainly not on the same page. And, you know, I would make the point that at root here is a definitional issue. When the G20 was first formed, the idea was for members to come together and figure out ways to cooperate economically to tackle the biggest global challenges. And I think that today there's not an agreement around the world, and certainly within the GP and the G20, on what those biggest global challenges are, right? Washington and its many of its Western allies in the G20 would say it's Ukraine. We've got to deal with that. Whereas, of course, a number of countries would say no, that's a European war. It should not be the biggest global challenge to tackle. So India's role, of course, is to navigate all of that and to try to figure out how to gently, carefully bring this very rivalry-driven, tense grouping of members together in some type of general consensus.
And among all the bilaterals, Mr. Leung, which one is it that is being watched and read very closely in China? Will it be this one, the visuals of which are on our television screens?
Well, I don't think it will be on Premier Li Qiang alone. But of course, that this is a forum hosted by India, and where the presence of the United States is very, very strong together with its allies. And there is no doubt that the United States wants to use this forum to counter China's influence in the global south. Don't forget that before coming here, coming to Delhi, President Biden has already coming up with various initiatives for example, on the infrastructural development, the so-called Partnership for Global Infrastructure Development, purporting to raise $600 billion by 2027 to counter China's Belt and Road. To the extent that with the rhetoric or the narrative that a Belt and Road is not sustainable in many ways and is not open enough. But if these kind of languages are written into the proposed statement, then there is very little chance that that China or other countries sympathetic to China's interests would agree. So I think that there is a great deal of vast amount of ground on which most countries would agree, and as highlighted just now, the climate change and also sustainable development. And in fact, the sustainable development goals of the United Nations.
And will China also agree, Mr. Leung, that India's G20 yeah. presidency has been the one of new initiatives and achievements?
Well, I don't think that China would oppose India's chairmanship. Considering it is by rotation. And of course, China's embraces the
globalization interventions. In terms of what India managed to achieve and you know, send that message, how it is the voice of the voiceless, the voice of the global south, the achievements with regards to financial inclusion, and all this is coming on a day that World Bank has lauded India's, what it says has been a transformative impact of DPIs, which is the digital public infrastructure?
Well, of course, China is very active on bringing about a more equitable world in which the voice of the global south will be given adequate sway rather than being under the thumb of a sole hegemon. And as far as finance is concerned, one of the worries of the global south is that the US dollar, which has been dominant in the global financial transactions, has been weaponized and tends to encroach on the sovereignty rights of developing countries, including China, of course. So I think that China, and as exemplified by the recent meeting of the BRICS Plus summit, more and more countries in the global south want to line up to join the BRICS, suggesting that they don't want to be held to ransom by a hegemonic world order. So I think that both India and China can play a role in this.
Okay.
But let's make no mistake. This is a platform addressing global issues. There's also a platform for the battle for the global south, in which the United States and, of course, countries like China and India are extremely interested and involved.
So you are essentially saying that this is almost like a forum to lead the global south. But the fact is that India is leading the global south, isn't it, Dr. Barai? In January, those 125 nations that came together, the fact that India managed to convince other members in the BRICS to expand, the first in terms of scheduling also, many would say that it has to do with when the leaders arrive, but the fact is that the first meeting that the Prime Minister had among the bilaterals was with his Mauritian counterpart, Dr. Barai.
Yes, you're right. India was a developing country. Now it is in transition. And India has a good friendship in both Asia as well as Africa. And it's trying to champion the cause of those countries who have challenges, who have not been well represented. Their voice has not been well represented at the world level. So I think it was great that the BRIC has been expanded now to 11 countries. And here also, Prime Minister Modi has invited 9 other countries, more from Latin America, Africa, and Asia, to participate in the G20. So the problems of the South can be addressed more at the global level. So that way, India deserves the credit for bringing it to the attention of other members of G20.
Okay. Let me go back to Michael Kugelman and Ambassador Puri. Ambassador Puri, I'm going to refer to this World Bank document which came on a very, very important day, just hours before the summit is to begin, and on the day when three crucial bilaterals have already taken place. It says that India managed to achieve in 6 years what other countries would have done in about 5 decades.
Maya, look, we have been pioneers in this digital public infrastructure. You and I are beneficiaries of it, isn't it? Otherwise, would we have been able to sustain ourselves through the COVID lockdowns, the India stack, the use of UPI? Anywhere you go, you can use digital payments today in India. You know, we have leveraged this technology, and let us be very clear, we have every reason to be proud, but the most beautiful part of it is that we have made this technology available to everybody in the world. Whoever wants, in many countries, have chosen to take it. And so the World Bank has very rightly identified India and recognized India for what it's done for its people, and is a signal for the rest of the developing world, and by developing world, including the developed world, that look, here there is an achievement which can be seen, which is there for everyone, and for everyone to take advantage of. Please do so. It's an India success story.
And as we look at the New Delhi Declaration, Michael, the Russian state media, in fact, to be specific, is saying that the US and UK are pressurizing India. G7 country is pressurizing India on Ukraine while India is trying to maintain neutral course. How should this be viewed?
Well, I mean, that's a predictable response from the Russian media. Look, I mean, we know that the U.S. and the U.K. and other Western members are going to want to have Ukraine front and center at this summit. And I think that the argument that Washington and London and others would make that, the G20 is about tackling economic challenges. And regardless of what you think about the war in Ukraine, it has provoked a lot of economic stress and economic crises for countries around the world, particularly in the global south. If you talk about the inflation and all of that, it hits harder in the global south. So I think that that would be the argument from the U.S. and its Western partners. This is not about trying to focus on the war in Ukraine. It's about doing what the G20 can do to try to bring relief to those impacted economically by this war. But again, I think that for India, the goal here is to try to erect a firewall between difficult geopolitical issues like the war in Ukraine and somewhat of the more lower hanging fruits, the non-geopolitical issues like food insecurity, and figuring out how to elevate those to the top of the agenda at this summit.
But Michael, the fact is that DPI cannot be really seen as low-hanging fruit. Even the MDBs, the fact is that these banks have to understand the new age or emerging challenges that are coming from African nations. And if India manages to send that message of greater inclusivity for financial inclusion, then don't you think that will be a huge political and diplomatic success for India?
Right. So you made a very important point. I'm glad that you corrected me. I mean, I don't think there is anything like there's no such thing as low hanging fruit in this summit, because there's so many tensions and rivalries around anything that it's going to be difficult for anything to be easy. And that certainly includes the broader issue of development assistance. And I think it's quite clear that the developing countries within the G20 and the global south would like the Western countries, the richer countries, to provide more assistance for climate change, for food insecurity, and so on, than the richer countries are comfortable with. So that's just, that's one big example right there. Your example was clear as well. This just gets to the challenge that that New Delhi has here as the host of trying to figure out how to generate some type of broader understanding, not necessarily a hard 100% agreement, but some type of general understanding around shared principles that could be highlighted in a joint communique. And since they think there is a lot of support within the G20 for India's goal of trying to focus on addressing global south needs, I think that will be a good starting point, and hopefully that will result in some type of some type of agreement to at least agree to the idea of this forum, this very prestigious, wealthy, influential forum. Yes. to bring more assistance
and
to the
world. And it sends a message and sets the roadmap for the world in terms of its financial challenges. And on our television screens now is Prime Minister Narendra Modi's tweet with regards to the bilateral which he had with President Joe Biden. He's saying, "Happy to have welcomed POTUS Joe Biden to 7 Lok Kalyan Marg. Our meeting was very productive. We were able to discuss numerous topics which will further economic and people-to-people linkages between India and USA. The friendship between our nations will continue to play a great role in furthering global good." Andrew Kipping Leung, I'm coming to you again on this. Every word here will be watched very closely, and I will certainly highlight the bonhomie that is on display.
Well, this no doubt highlights the strategic importance the Chinese leadership views this G20 in the sense that this is a platform probably used by the United States along with Western allies and also its Indian allies to further agenda, Western agenda, in a position to what are perceived to be China's failings in terms of the Belt and Road development, in terms of the trade practices. But I think that I've no doubt that if there's going to be a common statement, then strong words like these will not appear. I think what are going to appear are likely to be actionable general principles, which most people would agree. But then these principles could be used to highlight the conflict between the United States and China, and of course, to a certain extent, the war in Ukraine. But most of all, apart from these problematic areas, I think there is a great deal of common ground on agendas like climate change, sustainable development, and as I was saying, the other sustainable development goals.
So the SDG goals are important, multilateral development banks, and how these institutions should realize, you know, that it should become more efficient. All that is a focus, but coming on this, you know, the point that is being made, Dr. Barai, here is also of the personal connect that is visible in this entire G20 summit. Would you say that you know, that look east policy that is on display, the fact that Prime Minister Modi says, you know, look towards your neighbors first policy. You have here Sheikh Hasina being invited, and she was there at the bilateral which happened at LKM. Do you think that personal connect has meant that he's able to leverage his position and on the diplomatic landscape better?
Maria, you hit it right on the bullseye. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has developed personal bond homie between himself and many, many leaders of the world, starting with President Biden. He even has a good relationship with President Putin and many other leaders that you mentioned about, both our neighbors and those are our distant neighbors. So you can get many things done as friends, then you can get it done as a diplomat or, of course, as a foe. And he has been leveraging his personal friendship, personal good charm that he has developed with the world leaders to try to get many things done. We have seen that he has done the same thing with the Indian diaspora. He has done same thing with the world leaders. And I commend him for his camaraderie.
Okay, I have just enough time for the final word from Ambassador Puri, Michael Kugelman, and Andrew Leung. Michael Kugelman, would you really want a Delhi declaration, perhaps a joint statement that would be the real success? Or would you say that in this 10 months, India has sent enough and more messages of its diplomatic success of G20 presidency, and that will be perhaps just the icing on the cake?
Well, I agree that we shouldn't place too much stock in the need to get some type of final consensus document, though it still is very important. I mean, given the past history that, you know, whenever you've had a G20 leader summit, you know, there typically has been some type of joint communique, including last year in Indonesia when, you know, many of the current geopolitical rivalries playing out were very sharp then as well. And I think it is possible. And one thing that was clever about the Bali Declaration last year is that it was very transparent about where there was not agreement between the members. It would talk about most members agreeing to, many members agreeing to. Nothing wrong with using that kind of language. I just think the optics of, you know, pulling out all the stops and investing so many resources and political capital in this summit and then not having a final consensus product, the optics of that would not be very good. So that's why I'm quite confident that there will be some type of document, even though it will likely reflect a partial consensus and an agreement on principles and not a full 100% consensus, which is fine.
Okay. Manjeev Puri, I have just 10 seconds for you and then the final word to Mr. Leung.
Maria, look, obviously a consensus communique is something that everybody would like.
Yes.
Having said this, let me make the point. The G20 is not a treaty-based body.
That's right.
Here, countries come together and agree to work together, either domestically or in the relevant de jure bodies where action has to be taken. In my understanding, the fact that generally on a number of subjects which are important to the global south, which are important to the globe as such, whether it is climate finance, sustainability, whether it is cryptocurrencies, digital public, there is general agreement. And I think, you know, let's keep this politics business a little out. If it happens, well and good. If it doesn't, we have made tremendous progress and the world, or rather the most important countries in the world, are at least in principle on for some of the most important things. I'm not wanting to use the word low-hanging fruits, but perhaps the largest and most important fruits for humankind.
A success of India's presidency may not go down very well with its neighbors because of the understanding or lack of it that's there. But certainly, when the world sees it, it will be seen as a diplomatic success, particularly from the point of view of India having managed to convince these superpowers that African nations must be heard.
Sorry, are you addressing me?
Yes.
Yes, well, thank you. Well, I think that the too much has been invested in the G20 by President Modi for it not resulting in a joint agreed statement. In fact, most of the world expect this going to be a statement. And of course, Beijing wants something agreed with the group of South as well. So the trick is really to stay away from the minefields and concentrating on the broad areas of broad agreement like climate change and also sustainable development, and also doing something about the finance that are much needed by the poorest developing nations. So I think that there's a lot of momentum there, in China included, for there going to be a statement. And Beijing is unlikely to envy Modi's success, because after all, this is a rotation, platform by rotation. So I'm hopeful that there will be a statement and addressing some of the pressing issues, but not flagging up, using this as an opportunity to flag up a lot of the inevitable or intractable conflicts.
All right, Andrew Kepilian, Dr. Barai, Ambassador Puri, and Michael, thank you so much for your time. We are slipping into a short break. After that, a very special guest joins me from US. And you can see her on your screens as well. We have something very special lined up. Mary, hello to from NDTV. I'll be in conversation with Mary Milburn in just a bit. And joining me now is Mary Milburn. She's a singer, and she has performed for four consecutive U.S. presidents, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and Joe Biden recently. And also in August 2020, Milburn performed India's national anthem, Janagan Man, for the 74th anniversary of India's independence. And in June 2023, Milburn performed the national anthem of India at the Ronald Reagan building during U.S. Visit of Prime Minister Narendra Modi recently. Thank you so much, Mary. Your tweet has generated a lot of interest. Tell me, what prompted you to tweet that?
It's Myra, correct?
Maria.
Okay, wonderful. It's so nice to meet you, and thank you to the NDTV family. It's wonderful to be on with you. Well, I tell you, it's a very exciting time in India with the G20 summit underway, and world leaders assembled. Certainly, President Biden is there to participate in the G20 summit festivities, and so you know, I always get very kindly invited to speak about and be involved in these types of gatherings, certainly in my interfaces as an artist, very fluid with American politics and global politics. And what really prompted me to share across Twitter as it relates to the G20 summit was Prime Minister Modi's courage, I would say, certainly to present the proposal the African Union to become a permanent member of the G20 summit. As I said a few days ago in addressing the G20 summit, the Prime Minister is right on this move. It's the right move to make. India's proposal to include the African Union as a permanent member in the G20 is commendable. It's reflecting a commitment to inclusivity, and it's the right thing to do, particularly if I have to be candid. All G20 countries benefit from their economies thrive from trade and economic engagement with Africa. So it's only fair to have a continent at the table that serves the world. And so I thought it was a very courageous and bold move to for the Prime Minister to present that at the G20 summit gathering. And, you know, again, too, achieving consensus on this matter may be challenging due to diverse interests within the G20. That's expected, but it's a step toward a more representative and equitable global governance system. I think that's a really important point, that as we work to bring the world to greater measures of equality, it's important that everyone is represented at the table. And that was the sentiment of the Prime Minister's proposal, to make sure that everyone is included at the table, including the African Union. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak about that in a minute.
Yes, you've made an interesting point in your tweet, Mary. You talk about how, you know, voices must be represented in solving the world's most challenging problems. And it's about securing human dignity for all people. How critical is it that, you know, that aspect of inclusivity should be about including all, irrespective of religion, races, and nations?
Absolutely. Thank you for the question. Well, it's embedded in the theme of the G20 summit: one Earth, one family, one future. I think it's great that India chose that phrase, that statement, as the focal point for the gathering of leaders for the G20 summit. We're living in a time where the world is divided in many ways. And personally, I believe the vast majority of people really do desire peace, prosperity, a sustainable future for all. And so with good faith efforts, open communication, and a willingness to understand perspectives, I really believe that consensus can emerge. And that consensus brings us back to what's important, and that is human dignity. That is making sure that no matter your religion, no matter your race, no matter, as we say in America, your zip code, no matter where you come from, everyone deserves an opportunity at the table. Everyone deserves an opportunity, as I would say, to the Indian dream. We say in America, the American dream. Everyone deserves an opportunity to the benefits of freedom, free enterprise. That kind of mentality must be at the forefront of the G20 summit, and certainly as we go forward in developing a world that values human dignity. But it does require something of all of these leaders and leaders going forward across the world. It requires patience. It requires compassion. It requires viewing others as fellow global citizens rather than adversaries. And that's a little tough right now, certainly as you get into the complexities of geopolitics that are always going to be at play. Sometimes those differences are magnified greater than our commonalities. And so, again, I think if we focus on those commonalities, our common hopes and aspirations, rather than our differences, that will not only help leaders find solutions to the world's challenging problems, but it will help us center back on the importance of human dignity as we shape the world.
Those are great thoughts, Mary. You know, I want to understand from you, as someone who has often spoken for African nations, what will be your appeal to all the G20 leaders? What should they be doing when this letter, which has already been written by Prime Minister Modi to them, to have this inclusion or expansion of G20 to have African Union, what will be your appeal to the world leaders?
Sure. Well, first, I want to compliment the Prime Minister on his courage to present the letter and to present this at the G20 summit. Secondly, my appeal to the world leaders assembled, it goes back to what I said just a bit earlier. If I can be candid, all of the G20 countries benefit from and their economies thrive from trade and economic engagement with Africa. So it's only fair, again, to have a continent at the table.
Some news back home here in India, and this is pure politics, pure elections. The opposition has come out on top. It may be with a very narrow margin in what was being seen as a major test for it after the formation of the India Alliance. Parties that are members of the bloc have won in 4 of the 7 assembly seats where by-polls were held on Tuesday, while BJP candidates have been elected from the Hanpur and Boksanagar assembly seats in Tripura and Bageshwar in Uttarakhand. The opposition bloc has won in Uttar Pradesh's Ghosi, Jharkhand's Dumri, Puttapalli in Kerala and Dupguri in West Bengal. East Uttar Pradesh's Ghosi seat was a test case for the India Alliance. The Congress and other India bloc parties had all supported Samajwadi Party candidate who won by a big margin. UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, who is certainly on a very historic visit because this is his first visit to India after becoming Prime Minister, has made some interesting observations in that interview that he gave to a news agency. He says that India, right country at right time to host G20. What makes India the right country right now, given the kind of challenges that India is facing and the diplomatic tightrope walk that Prime Minister Narendra Modi is doing?
Thank you. Well, you know, as your listeners know, this is a rotating presidency of the G20 that India has taken on over the past year. But I think sort of my presumption is that at least two things contribute to that notion of India being the right country at the right time. One is it's the fastest growing G20 economy. It comes at a particularly pivotal moment for India's growth trajectory, its demographic growth. So that, I think, is one aspect of it. A second is just the fact that India has very positive, constructive partnerships with almost all of the G20 countries and many more, including many of the other countries who have been specially invited, with the possible exception of China, with which there are some continuing major differences. And that allows India, the fact that India is actually deepening its relations with almost every other G20 country, to actually shape the agenda in a very positive way, and hopefully, and we'll see in the next few days, get some level of consensus on some very important global issues.
And how much of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's personal connect, personal equation with these leaders matter?
I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer that question, but obviously in international relations, personal relations between leaders matter, and Prime Minister Modi has over now 9 years spent a certain amount of time investing in those mm-hmm. personal relationships. We've seen leadership changes in many of these countries, and yet we have seen, in most cases, continuing effort despite changes of government in many of these other countries, efforts at deepening relations with India. Personal relationships do go a long way.
Yes. And Veena Zikri, the fact that we have Sheikh Hasina here and India as the country which holds the presidency decides which are the countries which will be invited. As someone who has served in Bangladesh, the fact is that India has positioned itself in this entire 10 months that it is the voice of the most vulnerable, be it the Global South Conference, and now, which is almost like certain now, that African Union will be finding a place in G20.
Well, I think that the countries that India has invited as special guests and observers at the G20 summit reflect India's outreach to the Global South and in reflect the very important role that India has been playing in bringing together the countries of the Global South in putting their requests forward so that they're able to achieve through this new form of multilateralism that G20 presents, they're able to achieve their objectives. Because we have seen that through other sources, whether it is the UN, the UN Security Council is deadlocked. Of course, we had the very positive and ambitious sustainable development goals, but because of COVID pandemic, the attainment of these goals has been seriously derailed. And there is a very important need to get back on track towards achieving those goals and towards achieving a greater and more inclusive development, and that the developed countries must recognize that there is a united voice of the Global South, and the growth in the next coming decades is going to be focused on the Global South. 80% of the growth in the coming 10 years is going to be from the emerging countries. Hmm. So surely when we are willing to play our role in creating that global wealth, we need to look at receiving some cooperation, the appropriate cooperation in key areas like climate change, finance of technology, access to markets, and so on. I think when you look at it in the context of South Asia, Bangladesh is the only South Asian country to have been invited, and I think that it reflects the very positive and strong relationship between India and Bangladesh. Yes. This bilateral relationship has been described as the pillar of Prime Minister Modi's neighborhood first foreign policy. And indeed, you can see that it is effectively so through the positive outcomes that have taken place in the last few years, right through COVID. These developments and positive growth and completion of projects and interaction continue to take place. Our Prime Minister Modi was in Bangladesh in March 2021 to observe the 50th anniversary of the creation of Bangladesh, to observe the 50th anniversary of the India-Bangladesh relationship, and to observe the birth centenary of founder of Bangladesh, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman. So right through the pandemic, all this was happening. So obviously it shows that India and Bangladesh have worked out a very strong relationship based on mutual benefit and mutual trust. And the achievement of completion of the projects that are agreed upon is a very important factor in carrying this relationship forward. Just today, as we speak, I think the bilateral between Prime Minister Modi and Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina is underway, and we do hope for strong positive outcomes of this bilateral to carry the relationship forward. And I think it's a model for the rest of South Asia. It shows that through this relationship, we have also developed the sub-regional cooperation of BBIN, that is Bhutan, Bangladesh, India, and Nepal. And this shows this relationship can be developed for mutual benefit of all the countries concerned, even if in the wider SAARC context there are, very serious obstacles in carrying this forward.
While neighborhood first certainly has been the big takeaway because of the focus that Prime Minister Narendra Modi has put on the neighbors of India geographically, but one view which he has managed to convince the Quad nations and G7 countries that this is not an era of war, that famous statement that was made by him, Mr. Jaishankar. And he has been saying that diplomacy and dialogue is the best way forward. If we were to look at what the Russian state media is saying, that United Kingdom is in fact pressurizing India, that G7 countries are pressurizing India on Ukraine while India is trying to maintain a neutral course. If this is what, Russia, which actually seems to be the aggressor here, has continued to maintain because of its long-standing equation that is there between Vladimir Putin and Prime Minister Narendra Modi, and also between Russia and India.
Yes. Obviously India has, as I mentioned, sort of, a relationship with Russia, and has been quite clear about why that relationship continues to be important, including for India's security and energy and food security needs. But on the other hand, obviously India has at the same time been deepening relations with the United States, its allies in Europe and others, including through the Quad. I think what we'll see in the next few days is whether some consensus can be reached in terms of a collective sentiment amongst all G20 countries on the conflict and its consequences, because has been mentioned, the Russia-Ukraine war is having significant consequences for the global economy, including particularly for more vulnerable developing countries.
UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has arrived in India with his wife, Akshita Murthy, for the G20 summit. My question is, how is India's G20 presidency being seen by the UK?
Well, it's being followed incredibly closely. India has turned the G20 into a diplomatic spectacle that's never been seen before. And we also now have the additional interest of the UK's first Prime Minister of Indian origin returning to his heritage for this important summit. So it's being followed with great interest in the UK and receiving levels of coverage which the G20 doesn't generally get in popular newspapers, popular media.
You've called it a diplomatic spectacle. There's a lot of anticipation, certainly, as to whether there'll be a joint communique. Or do you think that's really not important, given the kind of messaging that India has managed to send, be it on the payment system or crypto or financial inclusion, the larger message of having African Union as a potential member? Do you think those message of inclusivity is bigger than a potential document?
Look, a joint statement would be a triumph for the Indian diplomatic system. it would not be easy to pull off given the widening differences between the US and its close allies on issues around Ukraine, most importantly. But India will nonetheless have achieved an awful lot in its preparations for the G20 and in what it says about India as a power in the world today. This is really the culmination of perhaps a 15, 20 year coming out party for India as a major economy and as a major force in global governance. So even if there isn't a joint statement at the end of the day, which may not be altogether surprising given the difficulties which we've seen in preparatory meetings on trade, on finance, on climate change, and on Ukraine, nonetheless, India will have still gained an awful lot in terms of how it's handled the G20 over the last period of time.
And Downing Street has called this visit of the UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak as historic, and what clearly is a powerful reminder, according to Downing Street, of the living bridge between the two countries. There's a bilateral with the Indian Prime Minister, which is scheduled, where they're likely to talk perhaps about the UK-India free trade agreement. There is increasing optimism that a deal can be reached soon. We do know that India's Finance Minister Nirmala Sitharaman had said that she hopes that this deal will be done before the end of the year. As far as UK is concerned, is there some kind of timeline that you're looking at?
Well, look, we've seen deadlines come and go, to be honest, over quite a considerable period of time. Don't forget the backstory to all of this, which was that when the UK was part of the European Union, negotiations were already underway in that setting, which started all the way back in 2007. When the UK left the European Union 3 or 4 years ago, we started a separate track of bilateral negotiations. These will take their time. We hope we will get there in the end. But no one wants to sacrifice the quality of the deal for speed just for the sake of getting one done. That would be a mistake. It's better to have a high quality deal than to rush to do it by some arbitrary deadline or other. And I think the Prime Minister is quite clear on that in his approach to these meetings.
Lord Johnson, you also co-authored a book, Reconnecting Britain and India. Would you say that with Rishi Sunak, who has spoken about his special ties with India, being at the helm, those ties will be further strengthened?
Yes, I would hope so. I mean, the UK and India have a lot that they can do together, working in all manner of different ways on education, on climate change finance, on deepening our trade and investment ties. So there's a huge amount that we can do together, and having a prime minister with a very strong affinity for India, with a deep understanding of many of the issues that India itself is grappling with, can only help.
And does UK see India as a voice of the global south with that push coming for the inclusion of African Union? Indian Prime Minister has written to all the heads of states, and that is going to be perhaps the biggest takeaway of his G20 presidency of India?
Yeah, look, it's a smart move by Prime Minister Modi to increase the representativeness of the G20 and to make more countries, particularly in Africa, feel that they have a proper voice in global governance. The G20 is an important organization. It brings together nearly 85% of global GDP. It accounts for, 80% of climate change emissions, 80% of global trade. So it's right that it's properly representative. Of course, increasing its membership will bring challenges of coherence. And that's why it's such an important test of India's diplomatic dexterity and skill over coming 48 hours to see whether they can actually manage to get some progress on substantive issues from this increasingly disparate group of countries.
And the fact that the timing of this summit and India's presidency, there are two black swan events that's there in terms of Ukraine-Russia conflict and also the COVID-19 pandemic in a very, very divided world. The negotiations have been going on. Do you think, even if it has to do with food security issues of climate commitments, that would be certainly a great achievement for India?
Look, I mean, the Ukraine issue does remain a point of contention between India and countries such as the UK and also the US and others across Europe, and indeed Australia and Japan and so on. I mean, there is a strong demand and desire for India to use its clout, its influence, to help end the war. It is a war, and India really would rise in the estimation of all of those countries if it used its energies, its diplomatic weight with countries around the world to try and bring this terrible conflict to an end. I think that would be an outstanding contribution that India could make at the moment.
Lord Johnson, in terms of India-UK ties, the relationship between the two countries, how is it in general being viewed under Prime Minister Narendra Modi's leadership?
Well, I'm just delighted that the living bridge is so strong at the moment. One of the things, I was a former UK education minister, and one of the things I took greatest pride in was the increase in the number of people from the UK going to India for study and research purposes. And similarly, in the other direction, the number of Indian students and academics coming to study and research in the UK. That relationship is super strong at the moment. And I think that's really exciting because India is a great knowledge economy and so is the UK. And when we collaborate in those areas of research and international student mobility, we can really do great, great things together. So I'm very optimistic for this relationship, particularly in that area of the living bridge that is represented by student mobility and academic mobility. I think it's super exciting.
The idea of people-to-people ties in particular, you have worked in India as a journalist, and that was the time when you wrote that book. And I think you missed that question that I'd asked, particularly about reconnecting Britain and India. Your own experience.
Yeah, look, I had the privilege to work with Dr. Rajiv Kumar, who's now at Niti Aayog, was then boss of FICCI. He was a great person to collaborate with and to work with, and I learned an awful lot from him. Look, there are so many different ways in which the UK and India can move their relationship forward, whether it's in the creative industries, in the realm of education, whether it's in the realm of infrastructure, project finance. There is an almost unlimited potential for us to do more together. And I'm delighted that the Prime Minister is in country today holding constructive meetings with the Indian government, including with Prime Minister Narendra Modi, to do just that.